Whitney Media, 1460 WVOX presents The Advocates with Richard Garfunkel. Provocative conversation about world issues. Now, here's Richard Garfunkel.
Hello and welcome to our program, The Advocates, on WVOX AM. My name is Richard J. Garfunkel. I am the host of this weekly forum. The program is coming live from New Rochelle, the Queen City, located on the Long Island Sound. It can be heard live streaming worldwide on WVOX.com. One can call directly to the station at 914-636-0110, but please stay germane to our topic. My guest is University of Connecticut Professor Frank Castiglione, and our subject is how the Cold War started in the wake of the death of President Franklin Delano Roosevelt. As I say each week, the mission of the Advocates is to bring to the public different views on current public policy issues. Public policy, therefore, is what we as a nation legally and traditionally follow. To that end, many of my shows are devoted to that purpose. Welcome, Professor Castiglione, to The Advocates, and thank you for joining me on WVOX.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here, Richard.
Thank you. Frank Castiglione has been teaching at the University of Connecticut since 1998. He previously taught for 26 years at the University of Rhode Island. He's a recipient of fellowships from the Institute of Advanced Study in Princeton, Princeton University, the home of my son who graduated from there, Guggenheim Foundation, the National Endowment for the Humanities, the Norwegian Nobel Institute. He received a 2002 Chancellor's Award for Excellence in Research and the Alumni Association's Award for Excellence, also in research. In 2009, he served as the president of the Society for Historians of American Foreign Relations. He has written extensively on FDR and American diplomacy during World War II, American foreign relations, NATO, the Western Alliance, and the Cold War. He's currently editing the diaries of George F. Kennan, which extend from 1924 to 2004, who was a critical player in the post-World War II American foreign policy arena. His most recent book, Roosevelt's Lost Alliances, which I have right here, How Personal Politics Helped Start the Cold War, was published by Princeton University Press this January. He was raised in nearby Rockland County, New York, earned degrees upstate at Hamilton College and Cornell University, also the alma mater of my sister. You've covered almost all the bases, Professor Castiglione. You know, in the last chapter of your book, Roosevelt's Lost Alliances, you wrote that Averell Harriman, former ambassador to the Soviet Union,
and also former New York governor,
right, during World War II, scion of a wealthy American family, and of course, as the professor said, former governor of New York, paid the most poignant testimony to his wartime boss, said the biographer Arthur M. Schlesinger Jr. in a confirmation of what Britain's Anthony Eden told Robert Sherwood. FDR was basically right in thinking that he could make progress by personal relationships with Stalin. The Russians were utterly convinced that the change came as a result of the shift from Roosevelt to Truman. Harriman added, if Roosevelt had lived with full vigor, it's hard to say what could have happened because Roosevelt could lead the world. Now, this is a powerful, powerful statement by powerful men at the time. With this in mind, could you set the scene almost 4 years earlier as to who were the big three and what was their and why was their cooperation critical in winning the war?
Right. Okay. Well, thank you. Okay. So 4 years earlier, you know, Franklin Roosevelt, President of the United States, Winston Churchill, Prime Minister of England, Joseph Stalin, dictator of the Soviet Union. It was an unlikely alliance. For many reasons. And also, you know, 4 years earlier, 1941, it seemed as if the Axis was going to triumph. The Germans had conquered most of Europe. As of June 22nd, 1941, the Germans had invaded the Soviet Union. They reached the suburbs of Moscow from the Kremlin. You could hear the German guns booming in late 1941. The Japanese were moving steadily into China. They did not attack the United States and Britain until December 1941, but they did that on, of course, attack on Pearl Harbor December 7th, 1941. A day or so later, the Japanese attacked Hong Kong and took it easily. They took the Philippines in the next week or two. They took a number of islands in the Pacific, in the Western Pacific, and they also took much of Southeast Asia. So by, let's say, early 1942, it seemed as if the Axis might very well triumph. Mm. Now, putting together an alliance of, as it's, of Roosevelt, Churchill, and Stalin, the U.S., Britain, and Russia, was a challenging thing. For one thing, there was the let's start up with the easy problem, in a sense, was the difference between the United States and Britain, because there had been a tradition of kind of the two nations, the United States and Britain, had not gotten along all that well between the world wars. The United States came out of World War One thinking it had been a mistake to become an ally of Britain and France in World War One. There was the war debts controversy. There was Anglo-American naval rivalry in the 1920s. And also, Roosevelt was, like many Americans, was skeptical of Churchill. Roosevelt's advisors told him, some of his advisors told him, including Joseph Kennedy, who was the American ambassador to London, said that Churchill was just a drunken sot, that he was someone who drank a lot and was just a big blowhard, inspiring rhetoric, but nothing substantive. Mm. So Roosevelt sent his aide, Harry Hopkins, his in effect national security advisor, although he didn't have that title, national security advisor, in effect, Harry Hopkins, sent him to London in January 1941 to check out Churchill. What manner of man was this prime minister? So that was one problem. Could the United States depend on Churchill? Would the British, you know, there's a real issue here because the United States extended lend-lease aid to the British beginning in March 1941, but that's why Roosevelt sent Hopkins to check out Churchill, because there was fear that the British might, after all, surrender to the Germans. The British might surrender their fleet to the Germans, and any aid, any planes, ships, tanks, food, and so forth, ammunition that the United States has sent Britain through lend-lease, that aid could end up in German hands. Mm. So there was suspicion there on the part of the Americans of the British. Also, Churchill worried, until Pearl Harbor, December 7th, 1941, Churchill worried whether the Americans were ever going to get into the war. Mm. Most of the American people wanted to stay neutral.
And of course, they both worried about the Soviet Union and worried about, you know, the kind of government that was run there.
I said the easy problems were between the U.S. and the British. But, I mean, then you get on to the worries about the Soviet Union. The United States did not even recognize the Soviet government for 16 years. So 1917, when the Russian Revolution occurred and the Bolsheviks, the communists, Soviets, took power in Russia until 1933, 16 years. Mm. The United States did not even recognize the Soviet government. It did so in 1933. But there was still suspicion between the two sides.
Yeah.
Churchill had made his reputation, or one of his reputations, in 1918, 1920, being fiercely opposed to the Bolshevik Revolution. He wanted Britain to intervene on a large scale militarily. Britain did intervene on a small scale.
You know, Professor Castiglione, we only have a short time before a break, but two critical questions. In the months preceding the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, President Roosevelt met Prime Minister Churchill in a highly secretive meeting which resulted in the famous Atlantic Charter. What was the result of that meeting, and did that? How did that move forward our relationship?
Well, it moved it forward, but not as much as Churchill had wanted. Churchill wrote to the Queen of England right before the that summer conference of August 41 that surely if Roosevelt had invited him to come most of the way across the Atlantic, actually the conference met off the coast of Newfoundland.
Right.
Certainly Roosevelt was going to come through with some kind of alliance. But Roosevelt didn't. He didn't intend to offer an alliance to the British at that point. Again, because most of the American people were against getting involved in the war. What the war did do, what the conference did do, what the Atlantic Conference did do, was to enable Churchill and Roosevelt to get to know each other personally, to allow their staffs to get to know each other, the military staffs, and some of the political advisors. That's really the most important thing, to let the two sides get to know each other, and also they issued the Atlantic Charter, which set out a series of principles for governing the post-war world.
I've got to go to a break. Obviously, that helped cement our relationship. My guest is Professor Frank Castiglione, author of Roosevelt's Lost Alliances. Our subject is FDR's influence towards the post-war. You're listening to The Advocates on WVOX and live streaming on WVOX.com. We have to go to a short financial news update. We'll be back in a few seconds.
with business news at 20 minutes past the hour, every hour. Here's the latest update from the Fox Business Network on WVOX Worldwide.
From the Fox Business Network, the Justice Department has reached a settlement with three of the publishers named in an antitrust lawsuit. The DOJ alleged Apple and five book publishers conspired to limit pricing competition on e-books. The DOJ says Apple and publishers, including Simon & Schuster, Hachette e-book group, and HarperCollins, which is owned by News Corp, the parent of the Fox Business Network, made consumers to pay tens of thousands of dollars more for those books. Meantime, shares of Nokia are getting hammered today after the company lowered its first quarter outlook for its devices and services unit. The company cites multiple factors for that forecast, including harsh competition in developing markets. Nokia says it expects no improvements in the second quarter. Meantime, U.S. stocks are seeing gains today after their worst loss of the year yesterday. At noon Eastern time, the Dow now up 85 points at 12,801. The S&P and NASDAQ also up by close to 1%. With the Fox Business Report, I'm Ashley Webster.
Hi, I'm a home. The one with a roof, walls, and all the things that make me yours. Things like your comfy couch, entertainment center, and that lamp you just couldn't live without. These are the things that you could lose in a flood. And homeowners insurance doesn't cover floods. Even just a few inches of water in your home can cost you tens of thousands of dollars. But in moderate to low risk areas, flood insurance starts as low as $129 a year. Visit floodsmart.gov to learn what a flood could cost you.
You can have your own show.
Are you crazy?
Call David O'Shaughnessy.
Are you crazy?
914-636-1460.
1460 WVOX.
Now, back to The Advocates with Richard Garfunkel on 1460 WVOX and WVOX.com. Join in the conversation at 914-636-0110. Once again, here's Richard Garfunkel.
Welcome back to The Advocates, and my guest is Professor Frank Castigliola, author of Roosevelt's Lost Alliances, and our subject is FDR's Health, Unexpected Death in the Cold War. We've been discussing how the Big Three evolved and how the American-British partnership developed. You're listening to The Advocates, of course, on WVOX Radio, 1460 AM, and live streaming at WVOX.com. Franklin Roosevelt was president of the United States during the most critical years of its history since the Civil War and some of the most dangerous years that faced the world. He had depended on a close and intimate coterie of advisors since before the First World War. Who were these advisors, and how did they help FDR in formatting the intimate presidency?
I think two of the most important advisors during the war years was one, Harry Hopkins, who, as I mentioned, was kind of, in effect, his national security advisor, although that post, per se, didn't exist. Harry had very bad health. He's a person who had to work in bed most of the time. He had such bad health. But on a key, crucial day, May 10th, 1940, the day the Germans invaded France and the day that Winston Churchill became prime minister, Roosevelt, recognizing the gravity of the crisis, invited Hopkins to move into the White House. And so Hopkins took up his residency in the Lincoln bedroom, worked in bed, manning the phones. And his one of his most important jobs was to oversee Lend-Lease, oversee the program of supplies that the United States was sending to the British, the Russians, and the Chinese, so that the United States wouldn't have to do all the fighting or most of the fighting in World War II. So Harry Hopkins was an all-around advisor. He also advised Roosevelt. He went to, as I mentioned earlier, he went to London in January 1941 to appraise Churchill for Roosevelt's sake. He also, Roosevelt sent him to Moscow in July and early August 1941 to check out Stalin. Was Stalin indeed going to resist the Germans, and were the Soviets going to, could the United States trust Stalin enough to stay in the war and to be a strong ally? Mm. So that's Harry Hopkins. Yeah. Another key advisor was Missy LaHand, Marguerite, her nickname was Missy LaHand, who started as Roosevelt's secretary in 1920, and she became his really closest person to him in many, many ways throughout the 20-year period. She became, in effect, his de facto chief of staff. She became the person who was the gatekeeper in determining who could see Roosevelt, who couldn't. She advised him on a variety of issues. And the thing is that Missy LaHand suffered a terrible stroke, which crippled her. The night was coincidence, but it was the night that the Germans attacked Russia, June 22, 1941. So at that critical turning point in the war, Roosevelt was left without his gal Friday.
Right. Now, in the last year of the war, you described the decline of both FDR's health and his critical need for personal contact and feedback on a daily and almost immediate and almost intimate basis. What had changed in the last year of the war regarding FDR's health and his usual coterie of advisors?
Well, that coterie was mostly gone by 1944-45, the last year. That's really the tragic thing. One of the things that Missy LeHand had done while she was alive was to bring new people into that coterie. Mm-hmm. But when she was gone after June 41, there weren't any real new, close, intimate advisors that FDR had. And FDR wore out people. I mean, he demanded so much personal attention, so much really affection from people, that he wore them out. And Harry Hopkins, who, as I said, had ill health anyway, moved out of the White House in December 1943. And Roosevelt never really forgave him for that. And another problem in the relationship between Hopkins and Roosevelt is that Hopkins went into the hospital in January 44 in a desperate effort to revive his health. That didn't work. And Roosevelt was really left without any intimate advisor, any person he could really depend on for the last year of his life. And it's really a tragic element in. And this man who's struggling to lead the nation in the war and prepare for the post-war era was largely alone.
Right. And in moving on to what, you know, your premise is, you know, there was a series of critical meetings that had taken place between FDR, Churchill, and his staffs in Washington, Quebec, and Casablanca. As we know, even after Pearl Harbor, Churchill spent time in the White House. Over weeks and weeks, he addressed Congress. Could you describe these meetings before our break, what they accomplished, how they cemented the often misunderstood relationship between their styles, and was Churchill becoming quickly the junior partner?
Yeah, Churchill started out as kind of the more experienced strategist. In December, the December 41 meeting, which you referred to after Pearl Harbor, Churchill prepared a long list of strategic memos. Roosevelt did nothing like this. Also, Churchill brought over a huge staff of experienced military experts. Roosevelt really didn't have anything comparable. But Churchill's initial advantage in knowing more about strategy and being more experienced, that began to dissipate in importance by 1943, when the United States, mobilizing its vast resources, assembled an army larger than the British Army, a Navy larger, an Air Force larger, and in fact, it was American lend-lease supplies that was keeping the Chinese and the Russians and British going. By 1943, Roosevelt had definitely become the senior partner in the dual relationship between Roosevelt and Churchill.
Professor Castigliola, we have a questioner. Go ahead, please, and give your name and tell us your question. Hello?
Yes, hello. Hi, how you doing?
Okay.
Just a couple of comments. I tend to take the view that one reason why Stalin might have gotten along well or thought that Roosevelt could be a good partner to work with was that I see it as he saw Roosevelt as his junior partner in the idea of this. I think he saw Roosevelt when he came in to office.
Hello?
He was campaigning on repealing prohibition. And also, he did not really publicize his desire to really recognize the Soviet Union. But I think Stalin really saw in Roosevelt a potential socialist in the making.
All right.
And I think that as Roosevelt went through his presidency, he saw Roosevelt's rather heavy-handed tactics, like packing the court and other things, as very much akin to his own spirit of strong centralized government.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your statement. Thank you very much.
Do you want me to respond to that?
You can respond to that, please.
I think that Stalin was very much of a realist, and I think Stalin saw it was the United States' material power, that the United States was, as Stalin said, no one could have won this war without America's machines. And Roosevelt was, as head of the United States that was giving aid to the Russians, that really is what enhanced Roosevelt's importance in Stalin's mind. Stalin also saw the United States as a valuable ally. After the war, What Stalin wanted above all was to prevent another German attack. The Germans had invaded twice, invaded Russia twice, and had done devastating work. And so, devastating work in Russia.
We have to go to
Stalin saw an alliance with the United States and Britain as central to preventing another German attack.
We have to go to a break, Professor Castigliola. My guest is, of course, Frank Castigliola, author of Roosevelt's Lost Alliance, a subject of FDR's health, unexpected death in the Cold War. Later in the program, we're going to talk about that issue. Thank you. We'll be back in a moment.
World and national news three times an hour. Here's the latest update from Fox News Radio on WVOX Worldwide.
Fox News Radio. I'm Ron Flatter. Wall Street is bouncing back from its worst day of the year. After losing more than 200 points yesterday, the Dow is up 101 points.
Much prettier picture today rather than the last five straight days of losses for the Dow. Traders were expecting somewhat of a bounce back. Number one, over in Europe, the euro gains, the dollar pulls back, and that gives the opportunity for equities to move higher.
Fox Business Network's Nicole Petalides at the New York Stock Exchange. The federal government is suing Apple for alleged antitrust violations, saying it and book publishers conspired to limit competition by raising retail prices on electronic books.
The Department of Justice is committed to ensuring that e-books are as affordable as is possible.
Attorney General Eric Holder. Apple has not issued a public response yet. The CEO of one of the accused publishers, Macmillan, says it has done no wrong. Fox News. We report, you decide.
This is Bill O'Shaughnessy with an important word for business owners in our region. These changing times, I think, present a whole new set of problems for proprietors, for owners of independent regional companies. But with all the change, I think, comes new opportunities. And thus, we recommend highly the Alan D. Rosenberg Company. Founded by Alan Rosenberg, he's a wonderful man, as a specialized accounting practice for independent local companies. Alan Rosenberg and Company know the pressures and problems of maintaining and growing a retailer service business in this day and age. With offices in Westchester and in the city, Alan Rosenberg and Company earned their professional spurs for over 30 years now, advising large, very prestigious firms and high net worth individuals, as they're called. And they have a special understanding, thus, of smaller, growing companies, where they are today, I think, unequaled in the field. So if you're satisfied with your present accounting firm and financial advisors, so be it. But if you're looking for a little more brain power from an independent accounting practice where they don't farm it out to a computer, we suggest you call the Alan D. Rosenberg Accounting Firm for a consultation. If you've been feeling it's time your accountant, and I feel like this, spoke your language and was a little more on your wavelength, Alan Rosenberg and Company. The number is 914-722-6901 in the county, or in Manhattan, 212-382-3939. In Westchester, 914-722-6901. Manhattan, 212-382-3939. These guys really know.
Today's public affairs and issue-oriented community programs are brought to you by the Westchester Law Firm of Berman, Bavero, Fruco, and Gauss. This highly regarded regional firm handles matrimonial law and difficult family issues like separation, divorce, alimony, custody, and reconciliation, and is widely known for the caring personal interest and compassion its highly skilled attorneys bring to this most sensitive area of the law. Berman, Bavero, Fruco, and Gauss, located in the heart of downtown White Plains in the Clarence Rappelier Building at 123 Main Street. The firm is led to this day by managing partner Henry Berman, a former chairman of the family law section of the prestigious New York State Bar Association. For a confidential consultation about matrimonial matters in family law issues, you're invited to call Berman, Bavero, Fruco, and Gauss, a professional corporation of highly qualified lawyers handling matrimonial law in White Plains at 123 Main Street, 914-997-7100. The Westchester law firm with the statewide reputation, Berman, Bavero, Fruco, and Gauss, 914-997-7100.
Now with your latest up-to-date forecast, here's Steve Pelletieri's Eye on Weather, exclusively on WVOX Worldwide.
Forecast Westchester County in the vicinity for this Wednesday afternoon, partly sunny skies and increasing clouds with some rain showers possible later today. Highs only climbing into the lower 50s. Mostly cloudy, a few showers through the overnight, lows middle 30s, partly sunny, breezy weather. Highs will climb close to 60 on Thursday, mostly sunny, lower 60s on Friday. Saturday's outlook, we'll see mostly cloudy skies. Chance of a shower, highs upper 60s. Chance of showers, middle 70s on Sunday. I'm Steve Pallitteri, Jr. reporting for WVUX Worldwide, WVIP HD.
Calling Mother Nature.
Thank you for calling.
No, thank you for springtime. From WVOX Worldwide.
1460 WVOX.
Now, back to the Advocates with Richard Garfunkel on 1460 WVOX and WVOX.com. Join in the conversation at 914-636-0110. Once again, here's Richard Garfunkel.
Welcome back to the Advocates, and my guest is Professor Frank Castigliola, author of Roosevelt's Lost Alliances, and our subject is FDR's Health, Unexpected Death in the Cold War. You're listening to the Advocates on WVOX Radio 1460 AM and live streaming on WVOX.com. You know, as the European phase of World War II proceeded into its final phases after the Allied victories at Stalingrad, El Alamein, Tunisia, Sicily, more demands came from the Russians for a second front. At the Casablanca meeting, FDR called for unconditional surrender from the Axis forces to shore up Russian resolve. Could you tell us how the first big three meeting came about and the differences that were evolving between FDR and Churchill?
Right. So the first big three meeting was at Tehran later on in 1943, November, early December 1943. Roosevelt was an incredibly charming person. He felt he could charm anyone. And so he felt one thing he needed to do was to have a person head-to-head personal meeting with Stalin, particularly because I think Roosevelt wanted to get across to Stalin that he really wanted to try to have good post-war relations, and he thought he could do this more person-to-person than any other kind of way. So Roosevelt had been trying to meet with Stalin in 1942, early 43. Stalin was resistant. Stalin was personally directing the Russian military campaign. I think Stalin was a little also nervous about meeting people who had much more education than he did, people more cosmopolitan than he did. But finally, Stalin did agree to meet with Churchill and Roosevelt. They were meeting at Tehran in Iran in late November 1943. And by that time, as I said, the U.S. had become the senior partner in the Anglo-American alliance. And Roosevelt thought that after the war, Roosevelt was really prescient in terms of two things, I think. One was that he saw that China was going to be an important factor in the long range. In decades ahead, China was going to be increasingly important. It was important to have as an ally. Roosevelt also saw, unlike Churchill, and this is a key difference between Roosevelt and Churchill, Roosevelt also saw that the European empires, the British-owned vast colonies in Asia and Africa, the French did, the Dutch did, but today Indonesia, that those European empires were a thing of the past. And as Roosevelt saw it, in the post-war world, the United States was going to be an advocate for decolonization, for harmonious racial relations. See, one of the things Roosevelt worried about is that a third world war would not be with Russia.
And
a third world war would be what he called a race war.
Right.
And this was sort of colored peoples against the white people.
Right. And Professor Castigliola, this was part of the separation, of course, the issue of India. Churchill never wanted on the table, the poverty in Africa. Now, there were always fears from the Western allies about either a collapse of the Red Army, a separate peace made by Stalin and Hitler. How serious were these concerns? And with all the Russian blood being spilled, what was the attitude of Churchill regarding a direct and frontal assault in the invasion of France?
Yeah, you're right that there certainly was concern that Stalin and Hitler might make a separate peace. After all, Stalin and Hitler had made a deal in 1939, and there was a fear that after the Russians had freed their own territory, which they did as of January 44, that they would then make a deal with Hitler, and the United States and Britain would have to face Hitler's army on their own, which they didn't want to do. So that danger never became a reality, but it was certainly feared. And you said, what was happening? What was your question again about?
Well, the idea that of the Second Front and the resistance of Churchill about early invasion.
Right. Now, Churchill, had been a leader in the British government in World War One. he'd seen, and he'd also fought himself. He'd resigned after in 1915 and went to fight in the trenches himself, something that Stalin and Roosevelt never did. So Churchill realized the terrible slaughter of World War I. He did not want to repeat that. So he wanted to postpone as long as possible the Second Front, which meant the Anglo-American invasion of German-held France. Because Churchill thought that would lead to, again, terrible slaughter, and he wanted the Russians to do as much of the dying as possible.
Right. Now, getting into the last part of our program coming up after our break, the Roosevelt's health. You write that in the spring of 1944, Roosevelt was diagnosed with advanced heart disease, high blood pressure, arterial sclerosis. He was also facing a tough election, was forced to take on a new vice president, and lost most of his confidence and was exhausted. Can you describe the effect on FDR regarding his extensive travel, the campaign, the stress of the war and loneliness, and also the stress on Stalin and Churchill?
Yeah, the wartime leadership was a killing job, literally. Roosevelt was the leader who died of the three. But Churchill and Stalin looked terrible by the end of the war, and their aides commented that they had aged enormously from year to year, almost from month to month. Roosevelt, as you said, did have severe health problems, but after he was diagnosed with heart disease, it was late March 1944, he changed his lifestyle. He had been a heavy smoker, cut down drastically on his smoking. He went on a diet to lose weight. He decided, on the advice of his doctor, he began taking afternoon naps. He cut down the amount of paperwork that he did. As he told a friendly journalist, "I've worked it out." He believed that and his heart condition did improve. I mean, he was taking Digitalis, which reduced his heart had become enlarged, that reduced that problem. And he had his a cardiologist, Dr. Bruin, by his side every day after late March in 1944. Roosevelt thought he was a man of destiny, that God or whatever, the Creator, would not allow him to die before he had completed his work of bringing victory in the war and also leading the United States, Britain, and Russia to a peaceful transition to a more or less cooperative relationship after the war.
And it's also interesting, as you describe, of course, the stress, the inability of Roosevelt to have that intimate kind of advisors, the death.
Misty had a terrible stroke. Right. And Harry Hopkins was sick.
Right. And of course, he had depended on people from Louis Howe on, whether they be Tommy Corcoran or Sumner Wells or other individuals.
They were all gone by this point.
And there was so much backbiting about it with the other individuals, sort of the heirs to his throne, the Bullets of this world, the Charles Bolins, the Harrimans, you know, all these individuals who were actually players in the Moscow diplomatic field and saw Stalin from and the Russian communists from much different perspective. Before we go to the break, how was Churchill viewed by his staff? There's an image today that Churchill was this great, tremendous statesman. Didn't Churchill have a great deal of internal criticism to
He did. He did. In fact, his wife sent him a letter in the middle of the war saying, you know, dear Winnie, you know, you're alienating, she said it in a nice way, but she said, you're alienating all your staff. You're abrupt, you're rude. You don't need to be basically so arrogant and brusque as you are. Churchill, every great leader drives their staff. I mean, Stalin killed a lot of his staff, so I mean, that's an extreme thing. But
he drove them over the cliff.
Right, wears out their staff. But in the war, it was worse. And Churchill, what Churchill's pattern was that he would get up in the morning, work until early afternoon, take a nap for 3 or 4 hours, get up, and then work until early the next morning. But his staff couldn't take that long nap. And Roosevelt, too, when he was with Churchill, couldn't take such a long nap. But Roosevelt complained about what he called Churchill hours. So Churchill wore out his staff. In fact, the King of England complained, got one of the memos that Churchill had prepared. He said, another goddamn 2 a.m. decision. A number of Churchill's advisors, close advisors, privately complained that this basically working through the night was not efficient in the long run, that it was wearing people out and leading to sometimes poor decisions.
Yeah, it's very interesting because we have these kind of myths about Churchill and even about Stalin in regards to their health, their vigor, etc. And I think what your book does, and of course what your thesis is that the stress of war was really brutal on these individuals, brutal on their staffs, and it had to affect their decision making. In the, you know, of course, as we move on to the last part, the, you know, the denouement of this relationship, in this relationship, we're going to get into the idea of the post-war. And Roosevelt had always stated that it was one thing winning the war, but essential to win the peace. Right. We have to go to a commercial break. My guest is Professor Frank Castigliola, author of Roosevelt's Lost Alliances. Our subject is FDR's health, unexpected death in the Cold War. You're listening to The Advocates on WVOX Radio 1460, live streaming at WVOX.com. And we'll go to a commercial break, and we'll be back in a few moments. Thank you.
About 25 minutes after takeoff, a phoned-in bomb threat was received by its U.S. call center. Airline officials then decided to turn the plane around, and it was safely escorted by two U.S. F-15 fighter jets and landed at a Canadian Forces base on Vancouver Island.
Fox News Radio's Courtney Keeley. Fox News. We report. You decide.
New look at the Radisson Hotel right here in New Rochelle at 1 Radisson Plaza. The Radisson is the only full-service hotel in downtown New Rochelle, and their newly renovated look is something that has caught the attention of all who visit and stay there. The brand new guest rooms and state-of-the-art bathrooms are simply wonderful. The elegant lobby is designed with truly well-thought-out design features and is absolutely stunning. And coming soon, a new restaurant, the Noma Social, featuring Mediterranean cuisine. The Radisson, located off I-95 at Exit 16 and two blocks from the Metro North train station. For more information or reservations, call 914-576-3700. That's 914-576-3700.
When I need a bolt or a nut, or when I break a window and I need some glass cut, they got the solution to help me get it done. A local institution, they make hardware fun.
When we need to record a song, we go to the Loft Recording Studios. But when we need some hardware, we go to Cornell's. 310 White Plains Road, Route 22, East Chester, New York.
Cornell's!
We're always just a click away.
This internet is so darn easy.
Anytime, anywhere.
On my computer.
Streaming live at WVOX.com.
1460 WVOX.
Now, back to The Advocates with Richard Garfunkel on 1460 WVOX and WVOX.com. Join in the conversation at 914-636-0110. Once again, here's Richard Garfunkel.
Welcome back to The Advocates. My guest is Professor Frank Castigliola of University of Connecticut, author of Roosevelt's Lost Alliances. Our subject is FDR's health, his unexpected death, the Cold War, and how it emerged. You're listening, of course, on WVOX Radio 1460 AM, live streaming at WVOX.com. We've been discussing the Big Three and the critical World War II conferences. At the end of the 1944 presidential campaign, FDR won an unprecedented fourth term. The planning for the Yalta Conference in the Crimea was set, and the effort to get there was exhausting for everyone, including a weakened president. Could you describe the effect of the extensive travel on the Big Three and your idea that FDR was not concerned with Soviet spying and eavesdropping?
Right. It was FDR hated to fly, I mean, he preferred to travel by ship. But in order to get to Yalta, part of the trip was by ship, but it had to, part of it had to be by air. One reason Roosevelt hated to fly and was so difficult on him was that, of course, his legs were paralyzed. Mm-hmm. And when we're in, those of us whose legs aren't paralyzed are in a plane, as a plane bumps up and down, bobs up and down, we use our legs to stabilize ourselves.
Right, brace
yourself. Roosevelt couldn't do that, so he would be flopping up and down, even with the seatbelt on. Another thing is the problem is that Roosevelt had bad sinuses, and given the cabin pressure in those days, it was difficult for him to fly. So it was exhausting for him to get to Yalta, but he made the trip because it was important. He thought it was important to solidify the relationship with the Russians and with the British in order to try to have a more peaceful post-war world.
Now, of course, and we won't go into this. Maybe we don't have time. From what I gleaned from your book, he wasn't that concerned. They knew the Russians were spying. They knew they were spying. They knew where they were listening because he wanted to be up front with them. In other words, he wasn't whispering about them, calling them names behind their back.
It's striking that Roosevelt was informed that there was spying going on in the United States, particularly on the atomic bomb project. Roosevelt did not, we're not really sure why, Roosevelt did not tell the FBI to really crack down on that. It may be that what Roosevelt was doing, I do not for a second doubt Roosevelt's complete 100% American patriotism, but it may be that Roosevelt was trying to basically, through kind of a back door, give Russians some access about some information about the bomb because he thought of having the bomb as something that would be shared by the big three after the war. There was overt cooperation between the Americans and the British. This was one way of allowing a certain amount of cooperation with the Soviets by sharing information about the bomb, which, by the way, was a major proposal made to Harry Truman in September 1945 that was supported by a majority of Truman's cabinet, which he rejected. And I can talk about that later.
Yeah. You know, there are a lot of myths about Yalta regarding FDR's attention span, sharpness, and cognitive skill. Right. What was the real truth, and what was he trying to accomplish?
Well, the real truth was that FDR was, although he was worn out physically by the trip, he recovered. And commentators at the conference noted that Roosevelt looked better after he got to the conference, although there were moments when he looked terrible. He was up and he was down. But mentally, all the observers agreed, the British, the Russians, and Americans agreed, that Roosevelt was alert mentally. He was as sharp as ever, and so he. What did he want to accomplish at the conference? Well, for one thing, a key thing was getting a Russian agreement to enter the war against Japan. Roosevelt was facing the terrible prospect of the invasion, having to invade Japan, because, of course, we did not know the atomic bomb was going to work. The secret with regard to the atomic bomb was whether it was going to work, whether the bomb was going to be a powerful explosive or not. No one really knew that for sure. And so Roosevelt wanted to have Russian agreement that they would come into the war after Germany was defeated and help the United States defeat Japan. Because after all, the Yalta Conference was taking place at a time when the United States was fighting some of the worst battles in the Pacific.
Right, and we were losing 1,000 dead people a month the last month of the war. People don't remember that specifically. And 1,000 people a day, pardon me, every day. And, of course, the fleet was under attack. You know, it's very interesting.
And so forth, sure.
Right, no question. And, of course, all our information was the Japanese had 2 million soldiers of the Kwantung Army in Manchuria that would be turned to the home islands and be very difficult. You know, the death of FDR shocked everyone despite the way he looked. He seemed to believe his ability to survive, and many around him expect him to bounce back with rest. In some nation, which is the critical part of this book, and we have some time here, did his death create a vacuum for the anti-Soviet bloc and the new Cold Warriors to fill? Plain and simple.
Yes, it did. Yes, it did. The problem here is, I need to explore this in just a little bit of detail. The Soviets, you know, this is really where the Soviets were at fault, or one of the areas they were at fault, is they treated American and British diplomats in Moscow terribly. They isolated them from the Russian people. And so the American and British diplomats, most of whom wanted to get to know Russians, wanted to mingle and associate with Russians, were prevented from doing that. And so the Russians kept those American and British diplomats pretty much isolated, which resulted in terrible resentment on the part of Harriman, Kennan, and the other American and British
diplomats. You know, Loy Henderson, others. Yeah,
right,
of course.
Exactly. And so these people, the Soviet experts, who had become the Soviet experts during the Cold War, had personal reasons for hating what the Russians were doing. In other words, these diplomats had personally experienced the repression of the Soviet system. And after Roosevelt died, these advisors, particularly Harriman and Kennan, were the people that Truman turned to. Truman was inexperienced. Here, Roosevelt was at fault. Roosevelt was at fault for not educating Truman about foreign policy, but Roosevelt thought he was going to live. So Roosevelt dies, Truman is president, Harriman comes back from Moscow, races back on the plane, and advises Truman that the Russians are going to take over all of Europe, and that we have to change our policy toward them and basically rip up the wartime alliance. Stalin, as I said before, wanted to continue the alliance for the simple reason that he feared another German invasion. He figured the Germans are going to revive for 15 or 20 years. And if Stalin asked himself, who do you want as an ally against Germany, Poland or the United States and Britain? Obviously, the United States and Britain were going to be more important. And although Stalin wanted to control Poland in terms of preventing that Poland being used as another corridor for another German invasion, he also wanted an alliance with the United States and Britain. And Roosevelt was willing to basically allow Russian control over Poland in order to maintain peace in the post-war world. Roosevelt thought that was a price worth paying.
You know, in our last point, you know, as if he had lived, as Harriman, a Cold Warrior of the Corps, stated, could the Cold War be averted? Roosevelt, we know, was planning to go to Britain to have the greatest welcome since Horatio Nelson or Wellington, you know, if Nelson would have lived, of course, and go to the Soviet Union and may have gone above Stalin's head. In fact, the Russian people loved him as their savior. Could that war have been averted if he had a year more of vigorous life? Could he have balanced the imperial interests of the British and the defensive interests of the Soviets?
Well, you know, it's impossible to answer it definitively, but I think yes. Particularly, there are two reasons that I say that, because there are two main issues that Roosevelt would have decided differently, and he said he would have decided differently. One was the issue of what to do with Germany. Roosevelt agreed with the Russians that after the war was over, Germany should pay reparations to Russia, France, and the other countries that it had invaded. Not reparations in terms of money, but reparations in terms of machinery, labor, and whatever else it could help send to the countries that had invaded to help them rebuild. The American people agreed with that. 80% of the American people thought Germans should be required to work in the Soviet Union to help rebuild that country. That's a public opinion poll in April 1945. So Roosevelt agreed with the Russians on that. Truman did not. Truman didn't think the Russians did deserve reparations. Another issue, and of course the issue of Germany became a huge issue later on in the Cold War. Another issue where Roosevelt differed from Truman was over the atomic bomb. Roosevelt told advisors in March, a few weeks before he died, that we had to bring in the Russians and have some kind of an agreement with the Russians on control over the atomic bomb.
And you know what? He was had the world view to know that the science could not be bottled up.
Right.
In other words, the hearer...
That's very true.
Right.
Truman thought you could keep the secret, as if the secret was something you could lock in a safe.
Right.
There was no secret.
Right.
There was no secret.
The Germans were working on it. The Japanese were working on it.
And the Russians have been working on it.
You know, it's very interesting. My theory is, of course, and I agree with what you've said, I think everyone in America should read your book. You do very well from that. You could retire very quickly. Everyone should read your book. It's very interesting. It's very cognitive. I believe that the Germans got a free pass after the war to a degree because of the emergence of the Cold War. And I think we look the other way, unfortunately, on war criminals and the whole guilt situation is what it is. I think Roosevelt was the only man who could unite all these factors because he could lead the world. And I think he had that kind of overall judgment that Truman or any other successor wouldn't. I want to thank you, Professor Frank Castigliola, for joining me today. It was great. And where can your book be purchased, by the way?
If you purchase it on Amazon, is the best place.
Okay, thank you. Tomorrow is the 67th anniversary of FDR's death. I'll be up at Hyde Park. And thank you again for coming and visiting today. If you want to hear this broadcast or any of the other archived Advocate broadcasts, you can access them on my website, advocates-wvox.com, where information on all my guests will be posted. Next week, I'll be hosting Steve Applebaum, environmental expert and author of Restoring Ecological Health to the Land, and I'll be talking about severe weather, things to come. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to The Advocates on 1460 WVOX. The Advocates with Richard Garfunkel. Provocative conversation about world issues. Tune in again next Wednesday at noon.